Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, as the Colorado River Basin states continue talks on new rules for the river, President Trump has nominated a familiar name to a key post.
And dark money for dark roofs.
But first, the state Senate is poised to vote on its bipartisan budget proposal this morning and send it to the House. And it now appears as though the House, which had passed its own budget last week, may be on board with the Senate plan. The fiscal year ends at midnight on June 30th, and lawmakers need to approve a new spending plan and have the governor sign it before that. Joining me now with the latest is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So the Senate looks like it's about to get to work downtown. Is that right?
That's right, although I'm afraid to say it because I'm afraid I'll jinx it.
So what do we know about what's different, some of the big differences between the Senate plan and what the House had passed last week?
Right. Well, the House plan passed 31-0 with only the Republicans voting. The Democrats didn't even do that. So it was definitely a partisan budget, and it was a smaller one, $17.3 billion versus $17.6 billion, whereas the Senate plan was really negotiated between Senate leadership and the governor's staff. So it's a bipartisan budget plan, and they had sort of left room for the House priorities in that budget. And the House just recently, you know, came back with the priorities that they wanted. So now that those are being incorporated, everyone's hoping that this plan will be comprehensive enough and bipartisan enough and pass the Senate and go straight to the House and make it all the way to the governor's desk as soon as possible.
Do we know what some of those House priorities are?
We do have some ideas about it, but everything is in flux. Again, I'm scared to jinx it by saying, but there are some places where everybody seems to agree. Some things that we think we know will be in the budget are raises for DPS, for example, but there are also some last minute attempts to change things either inside the budget or through separate bills, especially with, you know, taxes and Medicaid and stuff like that. One thing that, you know, I can also say would probably be in this budget no matter what is extending a $100 million hospital tax, and everyone seems to be somewhat on board with extending education funding from last year.
So it seems as though, I mean, maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that the changes that we're going to be seeing are more in the numbers part of the budget than some of the policies. Like some of the policy that the House had put into the budget last week seemed like pretty significant non-starters for the governor.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. That was some far right and conservative stuff. And no, I don't see the governor going for pretty much any of it. That being said, you know, the budget does include like some political stuff, mostly it's expenditures, and everybody has a little bit of money to spend here. So there's going to be some road projects and infrastructure projects, things like that, pet projects, really, although I don't know if they would phrase it that way. But Senate President Warren Peterson said yesterday that they're trying to keep policy out of the budget, that that's not really what it's for, and they don't want to get in trouble legally because you're really not supposed to be putting policy changes in the budget. So I'm expecting that's going to be pretty minimal.
And Cameron, you alluded to this, but it sounds as though the House, with their requests incorporated, seems like they might be willing to play ball on this budget.
That's the idea. You know, everyone who's talked to the media, at least in leadership, has said that they're very positive about it. But that being said, you know, not everyone's getting their way with this budget. When there's a little bit of money to spend, it's not enough for everyone. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's still some fighting. The Democrats are somewhat okay with the budget, but nobody's thrilled with it. You know, they still want some of their priorities. It's not a huge win for them in any sense of the word.
Yeah. Well, you know, when he had Senate Appropriations Chair John Kavanaugh on a couple of days ago, he made that basically that same point that in a bipartisan budget, you know, there's going to be some stuff that everybody likes, some stuff everybody dislikes, but it's more of a I can live with it budget as opposed to an I love it budget.
Yeah, definitely.
So what is the plan then that the Senate votes this out today? Is the House expected to take it up today as well?
So the Senate is about to come on as we speak, and they're expected to vote on it first thing. So that's great. I hope that they manage to do that as quickly as possible. The House is coming in this afternoon, and then they can consider it. But it could take another couple of days to really finish the entire process. It sort of depends on how resistant the House is or supportive of the budget if they still feel like they want to make any changes. And then, that and a few more bills, and we can pretty much end this whole legislative session, sine die, get the heck out of here and get away from the Capitol for a few months.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Cameron, because there are obviously some other pretty significant issues still left to do at the Capitol, including the idea still floating around of a Prop 123 extension. There's the Chase Field bill, maybe an ag to urban type bill. Is there a sense that they can get all of that done and wrapped up in the next few days?
There is actually, and that's exciting because, there's sort of this last minute surge every year of not just the budget, but also some of the more important bills that
Yeah.
were waiting around for whatever reason. So those are definitely the big ones that you mentioned. There's this push from a House lawmaker to freeze Medicaid enrollments. And I don't know that that is something Hobbs would even consider, but it's something that they're pushing in the House. And there's another bill about banning China from owning land in Arizona that the Republicans are pushing. So
And that was something
definitely
that the
some stuff to
governor
keep an eye
had
on.
vetoed earlier and called for something different, right?
Yeah, she did call for something different, but then she said that she wanted something that's tough on China. So maybe that this is something that she'll like the second time around on reconsideration.
Interesting. All right. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with the Politics Desk. Cameron, hope you got a lot of coffee and good luck today.
I do. Thank you.
In 2020, Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced that his state would be the first to build its own border wall, intended to cover some 800 miles. But several years and more than $3 billion into the project, only a tiny fraction of the work has been completed. On top of that, the latest Texas state budget allocates another $3 billion for border security, but none of that is earmarked for wall construction. The Texas Tribune recently reported on the various problems that have derailed the wall, and reporter Zach Despart joins me now to talk about the story. Zach, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So it sounds like Texas barely has a border wall to speak of. As you report, the wall is only 8% complete, and what exists consists of, it sounds like, what, a series of disconnected segments?
Yeah, we did an investigation at the end of last year because Texas does not reveal where it has built border wall, and our investigation found that of the 50 miles that they had built then, they're up to 65 now. The wall, it's not one singular structure. It is several dozen wall segments, mostly in rural areas like sprawling ranches.
I see. Well, speaking of which, one of the more intriguing details in your story is that where the wall does exist, it seems like those parts of the state, those ranches you were referring to, are not particularly effective at deterring people from crossing the border. Why is that?
Yeah, well, what we found that what was driving that is the state's struggles with land acquisition. Texas purposely made a decision not to use eminent domain for the border wall, so they're not forcing anyone to give up their land. But what happened as a result of that was about a third of landowners they were approaching were saying no. So we found that the state could most easily acquire land in rural areas on those ranches where you can get really big pieces of land with negotiating with only a few landowners. The problem with that, in talking with border security experts, is that should not, in their view, be the highest priority for border wall. Urban areas should be, because that is historically where migration is more likely to occur illegally, where migrants and smugglers can most easily get across the border and disappear into homes or into waiting vehicles. So that's why they said you should do that instead.
Right. And I would have to guess, please correct me if I'm wrong, that it's also vastly more expensive to build wall in dense urban environments.
It is for a couple of reasons. One, you have to get many more individual parcels, so you're spending a lot more time talking with landowners on individual negotiations. And also, the cost of land is just more expensive, obviously, in cities than in rural areas.
So you reported last year that as a result of these and other expense factors, it would take, I think the figures are 30 years and $20 billion in order to complete this wall. And it really seems from your reporting like the state was not prepared for how expensive or complicated this project would be. Was there public support for the project at the time, and has that eroded?
There is generally public support for more intensive border security efforts. Republican primary voters, who are the most important for the Republican-controlled legislature, almost always cite border security as their most important issue that they vote on. So the wall is part of that they support. What we tried to outline in our investigation last year was exactly that challenge that you had brought up, was that in order to finish this project, one, they may not ever get enough landowners to agree. And two, the legislature, every session, would have to commit billions of dollars for the next 10, 20, 30 years to finish it. So it was a daunting task for them to repeatedly do. And that political will might not always be there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of political will and public support, though, there was also a pretty remarkable detail in your piece, which is that Governor Abbott's office had a crowdfunding link on its website to try to get voters, I guess, to contribute to the project?
He did, yeah, especially when he launched the program in 2021. They only got about $50 million in private donations. So compared to the $3 billion in taxpayer dollars they put in, that part was really insignificant. It was sort of more of like a public relations thing than an actual funding mechanism.
I see. I see. So presumably that money has now been spent on what construction has happened so far?
Yeah. They have spent almost all of the $3 billion. They have enough money left over to build another 10 to 15 miles of wall before they're completely spent. But again, they won't be able to close the gaps that currently exist in the wall.
Well, you also report that some state leaders there in Texas have suggested that the federal government should intervene. But if I read the details right, the meager progress that the state has made over the last few years is actually even faster than what the administration was able to do, the Trump administration was able to accomplish in Texas during his first term.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, both Republican and Democratic federal administrations over decades have built wall in Texas, but historically they're much slower at doing it than Texas was. The first Trump administration, and remember, like, building the wall was among the most important campaign promises when Trump first ran. They only built 21 miles of wall in Texas. That's only about a third of what Texas has done in the past 4 years. So yes, Governor Abbott here is saying, well, the feds can pick up where they left off essentially under the first Trump administration. But based on that history, they won't pick it up quickly. And it's also not as much of a priority for the Trump administration now.
So just about a minute left here, Zach. Speaking of priorities now, what is this some $3 billion that's been allocated for border security going to instead, if it's not going to go into the wall project?
Yeah, it will keep funding the other parts of Operation Lone Star, which is Governor Abbott's border security initiative. So that is largely state police and state guard members paying to send them down to the border to physically patrol it. Essentially, it's just a shift away from the actual barriers like the wall and more just on having humans patrol the border with state money.
All right. Well, Zach Despart is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how painting roofs can dramatically lower summer temperatures.
But first, Phoenix is one of just a handful of American cities to employ a city archaeologist. The position has existed since 1929 and is headquartered at the Sudovaki Museum. Unless otherwise required by law, the museum serves as the designated repository for all archaeological projects that are sponsored by the city or occur on city-owned land. And some of those archaeological projects are initiated when new real estate developments get underway. The current city archaeologist, Dr. Christopher Schwartz, stopped by the studio recently, and he told me that before a developer breaks ground, they call his office.
So we begin with an assessment request. So if someone wants to do a project, if a developer wants to do some work, they'll put in a request to the city archaeology office, and then me and Becky Hill, who works with me in the city archaeology office, will submit the results of that request to them and tell them, okay, here's what you have in the area. And on a project-by-project basis, we'll come up with what we think should be the plans for mitigation. So if it's an area where we know that there's an archaeological site and we have our own detailed, you know, database of where the sites are and what kinds of materials are in those places, we'll submit requests that say, okay, you know, we think we understand this area to be these kinds of features. You know, we think, say, there were, you know, a handful of pit structures in this area, right? So people have been living in that area. There's a canal segment that kind of is oriented right next to it. And so we'll work with them kind of from start to finish. You know, here's the permits you need, here's the work we want you to do, and here's the reports that you'll end up reporting for us and that we'll see.
And so let's say, you know, this hypothetical project is happening somewhere where, you know, there are likely to be some cultural resources present, and you make a recommendation saying, you know, you would need to mitigate your construction plans in a way that doesn't disturb these resources. Is that like binding for them? Do they have to work with you on that, or what happens next? Or do they have the ability to say, like, we've decided we don't care about archaeology?
You know, it's you would be kind of surprised how squishy some of those regulations are. But we do have a really strong historic preservation ordinance here in the city of Phoenix.
Okay,
actually, one of the strongest of, you know, many of the cities that we look at or look to for comparison. And it's one of the reasons I think the city archaeology program is so strong here in Phoenix. What it ends up with is we have an incredible amount of knowledge about, you know, how people lived, how they organized themselves, what kind of activities they did on a daily basis.
Well, can I ask you, this is a conversation we had on the show somewhat recently about both Phoenix's relationship to its own history and historical preservation in general. One of the things we talked about at that time was this idea, and I'm summarizing a much longer conversation, so apologies to the other people who are part of these conversations, but the idea, generally speaking, was that because, quote-unquote, modern history in Arizona in general and Phoenix specifically, that window is so recent. It's not that much more than 100 years ago that the state as we know it came to exist.
Yeah.
There seems to be this baked-in idea for a lot of people that there was so much time and so many people and so many different ways of life that preceded us. Like our modern way of life here is such a recent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there is, in some quarters at least, an appreciation, as you were alluding to, for the idea that we need to know as much as we can about what came before.
I would completely agree. I'm oftentimes looking way back in these kind of deep timescales.
Like how far back are we talking?
We're talking anywhere between, you know, 1,000 to 1,500, almost 2,000 years ago, we're thinking about. And so to me, the significance of being able to live somewhere where you have this evidence of people that had come before is incredibly, not just interesting, but, you know, things we can learn from. Also the incredible descendant communities we have in the area too, right, who are the direct descendants of those people. I think makes for a really special place, not just to be doing that work, but to be living and kind of interacting with on a regular basis.
Could you give me an example of some discovery you've made or some piece of cultural material you came across as part of this work that did reshape your point of view a
little
bit?
One of the things I think about a lot is we find fish bones at a lot of archaeological sites in the Phoenix area. And waterfowl, herons, you know, birds that you associate it with water.
I'm already surprised.
Right. And you're kind of like, well, what is going on there? And one of the things we don't think about, you know, the canal, we have canals, modern canals here. A lot of those canals were built on top of prehistoric canals that spanned miles and miles throughout the entire Phoenix Basin. From these canals were smaller lateral canals and even smaller canals that irrigated fields that were lush and wet and watery, right, and created these microenvironments that would have not only cooled the city but attracted fish and birds and created just a totally different environment than we typically associate with Phoenix, Arizona. And actually, the name Phoenix was named, right, because it was a city rising from the ashes of a society that or civilization that had, quote unquote, long gone. And we know now that that society and civilization had not long gone.
Right.
We know their ancestors are right here living alongside us. And at the time, of course, people were not so quick to accept that.
Boy, I hadn't even considered until this very moment, Chris, I have to be honest, the lie that is sort of baked into the name of the city. So beyond just, you know, reviewing dig sites for compliance. I know that part of what your office does too, and what you've been doing for me in this conversation, is education.
Mm-hmm. I think archaeologists have in the past done a really good job of kind of hiding archaeology from people with the very, I think, real concern that if people know where sites are, they'll destroy them.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of always been my take that, you know, the more people know, the more people are interested in protecting the community around them.
Well, I was probably not to the extent that you were, but something of an archaeology nerd as a kid, in the sense that my parents got me this book about the discovery of King Tut's tomb. Mm-hmm. And I was completely obsessed with this moment where they'd been out in the desert looking for this tomb and were digging in the sand, and they found a step and then another step. And then finally they found the door, and they went in and they found all of these treasures and this window into a culture from the past. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a kid thinking, it's so cool that they found that and that they opened it up and that now we all know about it. And it didn't occur to me until many years later that the people who buried King Tut there meant for him to stay there and for him to not be disturbed. And I am reminded of that in this moment because you were talking about the impact of human societies on cultures of the past. Mm-hmm. I'm realizing that I have mostly thought of archaeology largely because of, you know, this King Tut book and the Indiana Jones movies, probably,
sure.
Which I'm sure are the bane of your existence to some degree.
yes.
I have thought of archaeology as finding stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I hear you talking about is expanding your awareness, mm-hmm. which is very different.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that I think most people who go in to do archaeology kind of get out of the habit of is like, okay, people oftentimes ask, oh, what's the most interesting thing you've found? What's the coolest thing you've found? And I think most of us would say, you know, we have found some interesting things, but what's really most interesting is when you find something that's in a context, in a place where you can like really identify with that or understand. You learn something incredible about what you're seeing from the past. An example would be we oftentimes find like fingerprints in like adobe blocks and other kinds of things that people were kind of, you know, using to form structures. And to me, it's always like, wow, what an incredible human experience to find 1,000-year-old fingerprints on a block of adobe that you've now just, you know, seen for the first time. And it's things like that that really humanize the past for you and kind of put you into that experience.
Well, Dr. Christopher Schwartz is the city archaeologist for the city of Phoenix. Chris, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
President Trump this week nominated Ted Cook to lead the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. Cook is the former manager of the Central Arizona Project, whose canals bring water to the valley. If he's confirmed by the U.S. Senate, Cook will have a big role in trying to bring the 7 Colorado River Basin states to an agreement on new rules for the river, likely including cuts to water allocations. Cook's nomination has largely been praised in Arizona, although water officials in some of the other basin states have expressed concern that he may play favorites given his ties to Arizona. With me now to talk about this is Sarah Porter, director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at ASU. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of this nomination? Do you think Ted Cook's the right person for this job?
I think Ted Cook is a great choice for this job for a couple of reasons. One, as you mentioned, is that he's really familiar with the issues related to the Colorado River, and we're at a critical time. The 7 states that share water from the Colorado River need to come up with a new agreement for how we manage this highly stressed system. And really, they have a matter of months to come up with an agreement. And so we need a Bureau of Reclamation commissioner who understands the issues and can hit the ground running. But in addition to that, Ted was the general manager of the Central Arizona Project. And so he's very familiar with the kind of on-the-ground practicalities that all of the stakeholders in the Colorado River discussion live with. So he's a very good choice at this moment as commissioner.
I want to ask you about that familiarity with sort of the day-to-day situations, but also I wonder if there's an importance in having personal relationships with, you know, some of the water managers in the other basin states.
Yeah, I think it is a good thing for them that Ted has relationships. He knows all the negotiators, all the stakeholders. They also know Ted from his role as the lead of one of the major stakeholders in the Colorado River discussions. Clearly, there will be concerns that he'll have trouble stepping out of his Arizona, Central Arizona role. And I can understand that if the nominee for commissioner were a major stakeholder from another state, there'd be concerns about that. But I think because people know Ted, they know he's very analytical, very data-driven, very much a sort of fair-minded individual. I think people will, based on their relationships, people from other states will not have very serious concerns about potential Arizona bias.
Well, it seems as though Cook is aware of what you were just talking about in terms of there sort of maybe being a perception that he would play favorites with Arizona or the lower basin states, including Arizona and California. But I wonder, like, how big of a topic of discussion might this be at, for example, his confirmation hearing?
Well, the states are really good at leveraging every opportunity that they can in these ongoing negotiations. So potentially, I expect that if there are objections, they'll probably be brought up before he actually has to sit down in front of, you know, a Senate committee. Mm-hmm. And there may be states that are looking to leverage some kind of little benefit for themselves in order, you know, to they would not oppose Ted Cook in exchange for some little concession. That wouldn't be unusual in the Colorado River negotiations. But yeah, I don't think that we can just count on everyone agreeing to Ted Cook as commissioner without objection. There's a whole other element that's kind of outside of my wheelhouse, but this is a political appointee by the Trump administration. And so, you know, no doubt there are delegation members from various states who would also apply a more political lens to this beyond the water negotiations, too.
I mean, it kind of wouldn't be the Colorado River Basin negotiations if everybody agreed on everything, right?
That's exactly right. And every single stakeholder needs things.
Yeah.
And the needs are incredibly diverse. And so, you know, they have to take every opportunity to try to get their needs met.
So the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation obviously has things other than the Colorado River to deal with. But I wonder if the fact that the Trump administration has put forward Ted Cook to lead this agency, does that tell you anything about how the administration is thinking about trying to wrap up these negotiations or the importance maybe it places on a resolution to this issue?
That's how I read it. I read choosing someone like Ted Cook, who everyone understands can come in and roll up his sleeves and begin making every effort to get the seven states toward an agreement. I see that as an indication that the administration is prioritizing the Colorado River issues among the huge array of responsibilities that the Bureau of Reclamation has. You know, if you look at a map of the United States, the Bureau of Reclamation manages reservoirs and hydropower facilities and water delivery infrastructure from pretty much the whole western half of the United States, from North Dakota down to Texas and all the way to the Pacific coast. So that's hundreds of dams, you know, huge yeah. amount of stuff going on beyond the Colorado River. But I think the selection of Ted signals a prioritizing of this very, very critical system.
Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Yeah. Sarah Porter, director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at ASU. Sarah, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Nice to talk with you. Thanks.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. There are a lot of words used to describe how plants look or smell. Think fragrant, prickly, tall, or climbing. But there are also words that describe how and where plants grow, like invasive or native. It's that latter category that my next guest objects to. Liz Makings is collections manager for the ASU Herbarium and says words like non-native or invasive tend to have negative connotations, which can be unwarranted. She joins me to talk more about this. And Liz, we're talking about this idea of what are often referred to as native versus non-native plants. And please correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems that you believe plants that are not native to the Sonoran Desert get a bad rap.
I do. And I think there's a real issue with not just that they get a bad rap, but that there's so much rhetoric that it's attached to these plants. And it's almost always negative and contentious.
Are there particular plants that to you seem to bear the brunt of this more than others?
There are. And they're usually the sort of plants du jour that we love to hate. And I can give you a few examples of some sort of recent arrivals.
Please.
That are labeled invasive, you know, which is, you know, a word that gives me the heebie-jeebies, you know, and I really dislike. So part of what I do a lot is sort of redirect that and try to ask people a little bit more about, you know, how they feel about that and why they're calling it that. But there's a thing called Oncocyphon, and it's a little yellow composite flower in the sunflower family, and it's just sort of spread really quickly in a short period of time, and so people have noticed, and they've decided that it's bad, you know. And I guess the first thing as a scientist, rather than go to that emotional sort of label, I would rather we ask questions of what it's doing and how is it doing it.
Like, what kinds of questions specifically do you think we should be asking? Because it seems to me that there are scientifically plants that are not from here, right? That people have brought here or have spread here other ways. So, like, to call them non-native doesn't seem to be much in dispute. Is it maybe sort of the connotation that goes with it?
Absolutely, yeah. There is debate about nativity, of course, because what does that mean? You know, is there a definition that we all agree on? And it's the same thing with all of these labels. You know, we throw them around as if they're understood by everybody, including non-native. But I have questions about that, you know, and a lot of people just accept these things. But in reality, it can be just pseudoscience or dogma that's been perpetuated for, you know, decades that we just sort of parrot.
Is there something to be said for the place in which we live, which is so different than so many other places around the country and around the world, that plants that have been here for some long number of years are maybe better adapted to survive and thrive here as opposed to, you know, plants that are relatively new?
Well, sure. I mean, that's also sort of our natural way of thinking is that, well, they've been here, so they belong here. And the stuff that hasn't been here doesn't belong. And, you know, that's problematic too, because in most cases, the things that have been introduced, it's because people have done that, right? But it's so much easier to finger point than it is to accept, you know, sort of responsibility.
So how should we maybe be thinking about some of these species differently? I mean, you talked about asking questions about maybe what they do or why they're here. Like, how should we be thinking about some of these plants differently than we do now?
I think we should be thinking about our planet differently. And that includes our local situation. It's getting hotter. It's getting drier. We need to shift away from these adversarial relationships with plants and consider that something that has migrated from somewhere isn't inherently bad, and it actually might be part of the solution.
Do you think, though, that there are some types of plants that maybe shouldn't be here? You know, I think about something, for example, like buffelgrass that a lot of fire managers talk about as being a really big detriment when you're talking about providing fuel for wildfires that wasn't here some number of years ago. Like, are there some species that maybe just shouldn't be in the Sonoran Desert?
Again, shouldn't be here, right? This is the way we frame it instead of why is it here and what is it doing? And buffelgrass is actually one of the things that has been studied fairly well, and we're sort of labeling it as bad and changing fire regimes or carrying fire or reducing biodiversity or all these sort of kind of overused narratives that I don't know. I think we should always be curious and questioning them, because people that are coming at that research, it's typically with the sort of null hypothesis that it's bad. So when you're researching something and your hypothesis is that it's bad, you're sort of trying to prove that, right? Mm-hmm. But in many cases, it's really neutral or in some ways positive. Like, what are plants doing in general? Well, they're stabilizing soils. They're capturing carbon. They are shading the ground, so they're doing a lot of good things too.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that you sort of have to look at these plants holistically, right? Like, some maybe use more water than we would like, or provide fuel to wildfires more than we would like, or have other detriments to the ecosystem. But at the same time, maybe they are providing shade, or maybe they are helping with birds and bees, or maybe they're doing something other that is a positive
Absolutely.
To the ecosystem.
Absolutely.
So when you look at it that way, though, are there plants that sort of, when you do sort of that cost-benefit analysis, that come out on the negative side?
And I'm sure there are, and I'm sure there aren't. And that's what we have to do as scientists is to tease that out and not do it in such a biased way that we have this predetermined outcome that it's bad. One of the things that I also have a really problem with is a lot of people get introduced to plants in this framework. You know, people want to help. They care, They've seen what's happening in the Sonoran Desert and the changes and the droughts and the developments. And so we love it and we want to protect it, right? So they want to get involved. And one of the first things that's available to them is to join these crews that go out and, remove species that are mm-hmm. labeled invasive, right? And so this is problematic because the last thing I'd want to do to introduce somebody to plants is to tell them that this is something evil and we need to get rid of it. I want them to love plants like they inherently do, and offer other alternatives. Why can't we be doing restoration or doing some plot data or doing rare plant surveys or phenologies or pollinator studies, and I think this would get people a lot more jazzed than the call to arms to kill natives or, yeah. or invasives. Think about if you would ask somebody to round up all the pigeons and starlings in Phoenix and go poison and shoot them.
Because they're not native to this area.
Because they're not native, right? That's problematic. And thankfully, we don't do that because it's morally wrong, but also because you're not supposed to, right? But we don't think of that when we go and do so-called invasive species removal with plants.
Liz Makings is collections manager for the ASU Herbarium. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. As we've talked about on the show before, there is a remarkably simple, relatively affordable solution to keeping building temperatures down during the summer. It's called reflective roofing, and the science is fairly basic. By coating roofs in light-colored reflective materials, buildings absorb less heat. The results can be significant. By some measures, the physical temperature, of a so-called cool roof can be up to 50 degrees lower than a roof coated with typical dark-colored roofing materials. Cool roofs don't just help their individual buildings. Studies have shown that widespread adoption of cool roofs keeps overall city temperatures lower, especially in areas with minimal shade. In light of all this, a number of cities and states have tried to enact cool roof mandates. But as floodlight reporter Ames Alexander recently told me, they are encountering some surprising resistance to those efforts.
Well, it turns out there's a group of companies that have been working to kill and block cool roof regulations, and they've often been successful. The core business of these companies is making dark roofing materials. Earlier this year, these lobbyists for these companies persuaded lawmakers in Tennessee to kill regulations requiring cool roofs on commercial buildings in the hottest parts of the state.
And that happened in Colorado as well, right?
Yeah, about a decade ago, they fought back a similar proposal to require cool roofs in Denver. And at the national level, these lobbyists successfully spoke out against a proposed code change. That proposal would have expanded standards for reflective roofs into more climate zones, but that proposal was rejected after the industry opposed it.
So these companies that are working against cool roof initiatives, do they not make the roofing materials that are used in cool roofs? Do they only make the dark roofing materials?
No, that's the interesting thing. These manufacturers also make light colored roofing materials too. So I talked with one roofing consultant about that, and he pointed out that the industry is invested very heavily in building factories and production lines that produce dark roofing materials. And they're reluctant, you know, to shutter those factories and let that business go. And part of the reason is, well, this gets wonky, but one of the biggest materials used on commercial buildings is called EPDM. And it's a synthetic rubber material. It's typically black. And EPDM systems typically include these high margin accessories, things like steam tapes and sealants. This lighter colored material that is becoming increasingly popular, it's called TPO. Those high margin accessories don't exist to the same extent.
Interesting. So that's maybe some of what's behind these efforts, but the kind of forward-facing argument that these lobbyists are making is an argument about consumer choice, right?
Yeah. That has been a big argument for sure. And they've paid for research that has asserted that the impact of cool roof mandates is inconclusive. They've contended that insulation plays a bigger role in saving energy than cool roofs. They've also argued things like cool roofs can contribute to condensation and mold. Target has a lot of big stores that have reflective roofs, and it tested that theory on more than two dozen of its stores, and it found no evidence of the kind of condensation and mold that the industry was warning of.
Huh. Why would a lighter colored roof in their framing at least be more susceptible to condensation and mold?
I think the theory is that the reflective materials are actually cooler. Therefore, the any water that builds up under the roofing material doesn't evaporate away as quickly.
Hmm.
But leading experts on urban heat have said those studies are seriously flawed.
So as part of your piece, you actually spoke to a homeowner here in Tempe, a guy named Brian Speer. Tell us what he told you.
Yeah. So he's lived in the Phoenix area since the 1980s when, as you know, there were a lot fewer days of 110 degree heat. And he soon plans to replace the aging roof on an Airbnb home he owns. And he's planning to put up a gray metal roof with a reflective coating. And that's something that he says will look good, but won't make the heat situation any worse than it already is. And he said he'd completely understand if city officials required homeowners to put light-colored roofs on their homes.
What is Phoenix's current point of view on this? Do we have any cool roofing requirements here?
From what I saw, Phoenix has put in place requirements for reflective roofs on new commercial buildings,
mm-hmm.
But not the steep-sloped residential single-family homes and that kind of thing.
And we should say here that a couple years ago in 2021, both SRP and APS here in Phoenix were part of a cost-benefit analysis study which indicated that converting every roof in Phoenix to a cool roof would cost about $1.5 billion and ultimately save almost $8 billion. So it seems like there has been at least some work done here in exploring the possibility of making broader changes as well.
Yeah, no, that's similar to some of the research I've seen. One study that was done last year looked into the effect that cool roofs would have had in London during a 2018 heat wave that killed hundreds of people. And the study found that if all roofs in London were reflective, about a third of the people who died in that heat wave would not have died. So it said that cool roofs could have saved the lives of more than 240 people.
Wow.
And another study looked at what would happen if you retrofitted 80% of commercial roofs in the U.S. with cool roofs. And it found that that would cut the need for air conditioning and reduce carbon dioxide emissions by more than 6 million tons. And that's equivalent to the annual emissions of 1.2 million cars.
Wow. So just by making that conversion, it would be the equivalent of taking those 1.2 million cars off the road.
Yep, that's right. And, you know, I talked with a person in Baltimore. He lives in a three-story row home. And in the summer, his third floor office gets pretty hot. And so he decided to buy $100 worth of white reflective paint and then coat his roof with it. And after he did that, his energy bills dropped 24%.
24%?
That's
quite a few bags of groceries, I would think.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Ames Alexander is an investigative reporter for Floodlight, who wrote this piece we've been discussing, which is called "This Little-Known Dark Roof Lobby May Be Making Your City Hotter." Ames, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show, Shining Light on Cool or Dark Roofs, right?
There you go. Might need to paint the top of my head white with this heat wave we're
having. Seriously, 116 today. Oof. Anyway, for Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.